Hi everyone, this is Alex. I wanted to mention that the Cultured Meat Symposium is returning to downtown San Francisco for an in-person event. The event is taking place on October 22nd and 23rd, 2021. This year, industry leaders Sartorius and Merck KGaA Darmstadt, Germany will be returning as gold sponsors. Learn more and register at www.cms21.io. Thanks for joining us on the Cultured Meat and Future Food Show. On this episode, I had the pleasure of chatting with Larissa Zimbaroff. She's the author of Technically Food, which will be available on June 1st. You can learn more and pre-order the book by going to www.itstechnicallyfood.com. We'll chat about this more and also add a link to the book in the show notes. I really had a great experience reading through Technically Food because as someone who has been really watching and looking into the industry, and not just cultured meat and not just cell ag, but all these different types of food technologies, I learned actually so much from this book. And what I really love about it is that the way it's formatted is a really good reference such that when I have it on my shelf, I'll be able to pick it back up and really reference chapters, jump through and kind of reiterate on some of the stories that Larissa explains. And it's just really, really nicely packed with great info. If you're in the alternative protein industry, if you're in the future food and actually future agriculture industry, this is gonna be one of those books where you do wanna pick up from the shelf and reference or kind of share stories with. So without further ado, let me go into the bio and then we'll get started with a really great episode. So this bio is taken directly from the book. It's very well written, so let's jump right in here. Larissa Zimbaroff doesn't like to eat on the go, but is known to walk miles to sample something delicious. She is an itinerant fruit forager and will pick up a white loquat, fuyu persimmon, or green apple off any wandering branch. The story she tells friends will be about scaling the fence and how great the fruit tasted. College years for Larissa were spent at UCSD wandering the eucalyptus groves and beaches of San Diego. Eventually, she landed in the Bay Area. Larissa worked in San Francisco's tech industry for more than a decade, including at Gap Inc., Yahoo, and Flickr, but eventually found her way out. She moved to New York in 2011 and lived on the Lower East Side, where she earned her MFA in creative nonfiction from New School in 2013. She's written about the promise of fake eggs, the potential of peas, and how artificial intelligence saved a winery. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Wired, Bloomberg, Business Week, and many more. Her passion for technology is matched by an equally precious hope for foods that come from the natural world. She now lives in Northern California, where she's close to the mountain hikes and seaside cycling. Larissa, I'd like to welcome you to the Cultured Meat and Future Food Show.
Hey, Alex, thanks. It's so nice to be here today.
Larissa, please tell us a little bit about your background and when your interest in food began.
In my book, I write about getting diabetes when I was 12 years old, and it's when food had an extra taut edge for me. Everything had to be thought about. But as a 12-year-old going into teenager land, I wasn't really thinking about it in the way that the adult Larissa is thinking about food. But it's when I had to look at food differently than other people, regardless that I wasn't necessarily at the time really investigating what I was eating. As a teenager, it just wasn't happening. But as I got older, I started to look at it deeper, think about it more. And then when I moved to San Francisco, I had an opportunity to volunteer at a local food organization. And I think that's when the journey began for me to really enjoy food and meet makers and learn about ingredients and try new foods. And then layered into that was this fact that I had diabetes and I had to think about the carbohydrates in something or what a serving of a food meant and my insulin needs. And these things really helped shape me. So it began at 12 years old, shaping me into where I am now and the importance of food. And I realized in my 30s that most people don't look at food like I do.
There was something that you mentioned that I really liked, and that was something like, I learned to love black coffee and dark chocolate or something like that. And it makes me think, do you think that others that have diabetes also think about food in this type of light?
Yes, I think anybody with type 1 diabetes, so type 1 is insulin dependent, your body does not produce insulin and you have to take it for yourself. And it's very different from type 2 is typically something that comes on later in life and is something that can be avoided by changing diet and changing lifestyle. But with type 1, it's my pancreas stopped producing insulin and I had to give it to myself. And when I meet other people with type 1, you're like looking at in a mirror. It's like you finally met someone who gets you, who understands you, who knows what it's like to live and walk in your shoes. This like mental load that we have of thinking about food in a different way. I'm such a planner now. I'm so into logistics and like forecasting my future and mostly in what's the food I'm going to be eating and what exercise will I be doing that day. And I think that people with type 1 almost universally have that same sort of treatment of their life.
My 10-year-old nephew just got diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. So he's going through all these initial motions right now. I'm excited to see how he takes it on and reacts to different food and food choices.
Oh, yeah. I wish I had thought about it more closely when I was that age, but I also appreciate being a 12-year-old getting it because I just rolled with it. I was like, okay. Like giving a shot of water into an orange, which is how you practice in the hospital, was fun. I didn't realize what I was stepping into, the life I was stepping into. And I think that it helps to be a child when you get diabetes versus an adult onset. But if he has questions, I'm happy to answer any of them, Alex.
Absolutely. Awesome. You've been thinking about food for quite some time. When did you realize you do want to pursue this journey of technically food?
I had been covering food tech and thinking about what's my book because I was really excited about what I was doing and feeling like I had found the niche in writing that I wanted to be in. And at the same time thinking, well, how do I get to the next level as a writer, as a journalist? And it was definitely like, you need to write a book. First, it was get conferences to invite you to lead a panel or moderate. And Alex, it was so great to moderate a panel at your Cultured Meat Symposium a few years back. But then it was like, write the book. And as I was covering food tech, all of my friends and family, and even strangers, like when I would meet someone at a party, they would ask me questions. What does this mean? Is it healthy? Is it good for the planet? Or just, is it delicious? Everyone had a question. Everyone had an their eyes lit up when I would talk about it. And I loved that. I loved that idea of imparting the things I had learned and like both this like layer of having diabetes and thinking about food in a more, much more complex way. And then also just like knowing so much about the industry because I was covering it. And then also it was like, what am I willing to spend a couple of years working on? And who doesn't want to work on a book about food for a few years?
Throughout the book, we experience your interaction with founders and really their early stages. And I want to really ask you, what is it like to meet these founders in their early stages and then really see their growth? And in some cases, a few of those examples, it's really rapid growth where now they're still startups, but big players in the industry. So what was that like?
Yeah. In my book, I meet the Perfect Day founders at a hotel in Times Square. And it was at a very like one of the first US editions of Future Food Tech Conference. And they like had a backpack and they had milk that they had cultured in their backpack and they gestured to me to like, follow them down a hallway to taste it. They didn't have enough to share with everybody. So it was this very like secretive thing. And it was exciting being in on something and it was exciting being part of something like top secret. And this like willingness to share their mission and share their science and their backgrounds in this like really enthusiastic way. And most of these founders are young. And so it is exciting to meet the founders, to talk to them. I think we all like to meet people whose work is their mission, more so than when you ask someone about their work and they don't really want to talk about it or they really don't have anything to share. I think we really like talking to people that are so passionate about what they do. And the book was a way for me to bring the questions to mind that are like, there's passion, there's mission, and there's science. And what does that mean for consumers and for food lovers and for people that eat and want to think about what they're eating? As a journalist and as someone with diabetes, I can't just blindly accept that all foods are right for me. And getting to the bottom of all of this was the book for me. And meeting the founders is exciting, but it's also something that I want to like pause and make sure that it's not just that excitement of VC funding, of enthusiasm for the market and capitalism. You know, it's also, wait a second, I'm a human that needs to eat food. And what does that mean for me? Lots of interesting things there.
Great. So that's super exciting. And I think to actually step back a little bit in terms of how you approach kind of stories in the book, maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you call big food with some of the companies that are in the space or incumbents and the startups that you call new food. Can you tell us and the audience what this means and actually why it matters?
Yeah, that's a great question, Alex, because we've been under the auspices of big food for so long, from when industrialization became like a thing for our food and when we started getting Wonder Bread and food off assembly lines. So big food has become just the structure of our food system. And it's the Nestle's, it's the Coca-Cola, the Pepsi, the General Mills. It's all these companies that we see have seen logos on for so long, and we no longer question them. And as someone that writes about food and thinks about things in a little more critical way, it's a grouping that I think about. And so then as I watched these startups start tackling the same industry, I brought it to like these new foods. And when I started to see the similarities was when I was at a conference, and it was actually that same conference when I first met the Perfect Day founders, Ryan and Parimal. There was a talk that was something along the lines of following in the footsteps of big food, lessons we can learn. And that's when I started to wonder, should I be worried about this element of following in the footsteps of big food? And it was something that gave me pause. I wanted us to think about it. Is that a good thing? Yes, big food's making tons of money, but is that good? Is what they're making for us good? Is our American diet healthy as we see the health problems, especially with the pandemic that's still lingering and how hard it hit the US? We're seeing it hit India right now, and we've been farming out our American diet to other countries, and we are seeing the problems that arise from that. So this tension between big food and new food is very real for me, and I just want us to be careful and think about it. And then again, it's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
For this next question, I really want to start off by mentioning that when I'm typically speaking to researchers at scientific conferences about cell cultured meat, and I really ask them, when do you think this will be available in mass? The answer I actually usually get is 15 to 20 years, right? 15 to 20 years, maybe the research will mature soon and then we'll get it to scale. Very different than what we typically hear about what the startups are touting that's going to be out in the market by the end of the year. We're already seeing it in Singapore. And in Technically Food, you have a chapter that's dedicated to what we'll be eating in 20 years, where you ask these prominent figures. I think Mark Cuban was actually in there too. Some past guests on the show, such as Ali Buzari and Lisa Feria, really asking them, what will we be eating in 20 years? I want to ask you, why is this an important question to be asking?
Alex, that's a great question, this 20 years. Many people that I talked to actually didn't want to answer the forecasting question. They understand why I'm asking, but don't love forecasting. And especially with things like cultured meat, it is a big risk because every company is saying, oh, next year. Just was before they launched in Singapore. In actuality, they had been saying they were coming out with cultured meat for a long time and they kept missing the mark. So I think deciding what we'll see on our plate was important for me to ask, but it's also this complicated question that people don't necessarily love answering. But what I loved about asking people this question specifically in that last chapter was people got to fantasize. They got to like play with what might be on our plate. Paul Shapiro said it was this like crazy turducken, cultured meat turducken kind of idea. And then there's like the Marion Nestle, who's hopeful. This is what I want. I want to see real food on our plate. And it was this mix of people getting to fantasize about what might happen and play around with what's possible. But then also it became these like hopeful moments where people could talk about what it was they wanted. In my book, my story is I have diabetes and I want food to be better for people like me. And food that's good for me is good for everybody. I love this hopeful moment where each person can bring their own story to the question and decide what they are most excited about seeing. And so the chapter became this like lovely back and forth between fantasizing about what might happen with all these new foods, but then also what it was they wanted to see. And it is why food is so complicated, because we all want something different on our plate.
In that chapter, I think you also list the age of the people that you ask.
Yeah.
For me, initially, it was like, oh, this is a nice way to picture the person in my head if I have not met them before or heard of them before. But then because of this question specifically, it gives a lot of volume, makes it like a bi-directional answer. Any thoughts on the decision to include the age?
Yeah, I think context is so key. I think knowing where the person is coming from, knowing what they might have grown up with. I hedge a little. I don't necessarily love sharing my age, but I'm 49. And even talking about giving an insulin shot to an orange is sort of outdated now, because maybe for 20, 30, 40 years, that's how people were learning with diabetes in the hospital, how to give a shot. But now in today's hospital, if someone has diabetes, like your nephew, he's going to get an insulin pump. Like, that's not even going to be a question. And so I think age is so important, because we understand what you grew up with. And so, like in my marketing chapter, I interview Garrett Oliver, the head brewer at Lynn Brewery, and we learn that he grew up in the 70s. Like, so knowing that he grew up with a supermarket of the 70s, full of what he called fake foods, what he called the matrix, I think age is important to understanding someone's lens into food.
Yeah, I think to echo that idea, that concept, it makes me think of when I'm talking to my dad, there are just certain things that he's very interested in, and he himself has a farm. So he's specifically about food. He's thinking about it quite a bit, but there are just certain things in his mind that are just set in stone. And I don't know if I was to explain perfect age to him, I think he would think it's very cool, but I don't know if he would see that vision of, okay, this could be replacing X, Y, or Z. So it's definitely interesting to think about that.
I think the quote unquote, how to explain things to parents with food is so complicated. And my mom, she still uses Equal to sweeten her coffee. And I try to convince her otherwise.
I have to stop because I'm just laughing so hard here, because my dad literally carries Equal with him in case the place he goes doesn't have it.
My mom too. She totally has a little Ziploc baggie of Equal in her purse. And then she puts it in her coffee and she stirs it usually with her eyeglass earpiece. But in some ways you think they can't learn and it can't change, but she actually told me that after one of my last podcast episodes that I taped, it was the one called It's on the Pass with Gabriel Morales. She finally said to me that she understood why I pushed her to spend more money on chicken. I always tell them, spend the most money you have if you're going to eat meat. Make it the best you can. And she's like, no, I bought these two chickens. They were so cheap at the market. It's great. I got this deal. And you don't want the deal on food. It is another area of interest that I had with the book, which is this like push to get down in price for all of the founders. Impossible and Beyond are really pushing their price down, even if it's like an Amazon move, which is that they're not making money. This like striving to make food cheap is a problem, I think, that our food system hasn't figured out. Access needs to be there. We need people to be able to access food, but we don't want it to be cheap. I took our parent topic and took it awry, but it is something I talk about in the book, is this struggle between creating cheap food and access. It's complicated.
Your interactions and from attending conferences, I think Future Food Tech was the one that you said you've attended every single year, with that story of the Perfect Day founders, which I have this perfect image of it in my head. You framed it very well. I want to really ask you, why are personal interactions so important, right? And this is a question coming as we are slowly and hopefully getting out of the pandemic. Why are personal interactions so important?
Yeah, I was lucky enough to get to see and meet everybody in my book, except for there was maybe one thing I didn't get to taste, one or two things I didn't get to taste. And my last visit was to Memphis Meats in January of 2020. That was my last in person. So yeah, these origin stories are, well, one, they're important to understand because they're being used as marketing, right? So just like there's the farmer at the farmer's market that we love to meet and know who's growing our food, these founders want us to know what they're doing and who they are and that there's a story. I think there's a new brand out called Nature's Find, FYND, and they've found the fungus that they're using in hot springs in Yellowstone Park. And they want us to know that. They want us to know where they found their thing. They want us to understand that there's a story to their food. And it's exciting and interesting, and it helps turn the page in the book, these like personal interactions. So like at the base level, it's just like, how can I keep people turning the pages to learn about food when sometimes it's a little dense and sometimes it's a little scientific? And then how can I make it fun and engaging? And it's by putting people into the book. But it's also important that we know that our food is, and what we put in our mouths and our bodies is so important. And we have to learn how to see the difference between the enthusiasm and the story of a founder and what it is that they're making.
The startups in the new food category, as we described, are growing and changing fast, and that's whether they're in the cell-cultured meat industry or otherwise. What's really the best way to stay up to date on the latest changes in this exciting future food industry?
Yeah, it's become mainstream. The New York Times writes about it, the Wall Street Journal. So it's definitely reading about foods in all of the different media locations that you can. I think that one of the number one ways to understand your food better is to look at the ingredients and to look at the back of the label, because you'll find the stories, you'll find an ingredient you don't understand. I mean, I think QR codes, because of the pandemic, I think QR codes are going to really pick up on food, so that you can just scan it on your phone, get to a website, and you're in the market, and you'll instantly know like what it is that you're looking at. Because like, I'm still finding ingredients I don't know. I just had some fake tuna that had tree hellos in it, which turns out to be both a binder and a sweetener, but I'd never heard of it. So just the fact that I'm still learning is like one of those signs that the industry is really evolving rapidly. And I know it's a lot to take in, but the more you can read, the more you can be informed, the better choices you can make. I have a newsletter that I send out every Friday full of little tidbits that I think are interesting. So you can definitely sign up for my newsletter on my website, which is my name. So that's a lightweight way that you can do it. But I think the quickest way is to look at ingredients, look at the back of a package. And when you don't know something, just like when you don't know a word, look it up and learn more.
You can get in touch with Larissa at itstechnicallyfood.com. Where you can also pre-order the book. It's going to be coming out on June 1st. Pre-orders are available now. Larissa, do you have any additional insights for our listeners today?
Yeah, if you want to order the book, you can get it from any local bookstore. Galax said it's out June 1st, and the audio is available. I'll be doing the audio, which is very exciting. I will be taping that in a couple weeks. So if you like my voice, you can listen to me. I have a virtual bookstore event with Book Passage on June 14th that you can attend, which should be great. And I will also be on KQED Forum on June 1st at 9 a.m., and you can listen to me there.
Larissa, thank you so much for being with us today and sharing your insights on the Future Food Show.
Thank you, Alex. This was wonderful.
This is your host, Alex, and we look forward to being with you on our next episode.
This program was produced by H Media. We'll see you soon.